I think we should, let's go ahead and get, let's get started. So I want to welcome everyone. My name is Peter Tribowitz. I'm the head of the department here, which is hosting today's event. So this is the second year, come on in, that the department has supported a, I need to move this out of the way, I'm going to just fall right over it, a PhD student-led initiative to bring together a group of leading and rising scholars from different subfields in the discipline to reflect on some recent development or developments or trend in world politics, to talk about what those developments mean to them, to their respective fields within the discipline, and to speculate, talk a bit about possible responses by the international community. This year's topic is the Doomsday Clock and the recent movement of its minute hand towards midnight or Doomsday, a very cheery topic. For those of us who grew up in the shadow of the Cold War, the Doomsday Clock, of course, was an ever-present reality. It was introduced by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 1947, and it really became a widely invoked metaphor for how close the world was moving at any kind of single point in time to global catastrophe. And it was, you know, it was popularized by Stanley Kubrick, actually, in Dr. Strangelove. Do I have any Dr. Strangelove fans? So as the Doomsday Machine, a human design machine that would trigger a global conflagration in response to even a single first use of nuclear weapons, a limited strike. And for much of the Cold War, the Bulletin scientists set the minute hand somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 minutes to midnight, though there were periods in the 1950s, and especially in the early to mid-1950s following the U.S. Detonation of a thermonuclear device in 1952, where it got to 2 minutes before midnight, and then again in the 1980s during the Reagan years, the early Reagan years, it also, I think it got to 3 minutes before midnight. And following the end of the Cold War, the Bulletin decided that actually things were looking pretty good, and they moved the minute hand back to somewhere between 15 and 17 minutes. You know, it was the end of history. Liberalism had triumphed. And the possibility of a global catastrophe seemed to be receding. Well, those happy days are gone, and we've come full circle. And really, what's been happening for about a decade now is the hand has been moving closer and closer to midnight, and January of this year, so just a few months ago, the Bulletin set it at 2 minutes before Doomsday. So I suppose that means this is a particularly ripe, good moment to be reflecting on the risks and the dangers for us. Are things really as desperate as the Bulletin claims that they are, and to speculate about possible pathways for reducing the possibility of global catastrophe. And we're very fortunate today to have four scholars and analysts from different parts of the discipline who are well-placed to begin the conversation, thinking through these issues. Dr. Malfred Brod-Hegheimer is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Oslo. Professor Kate McNamara is Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Dr. Axel Marx is the Deputy Director of the Leuven Center for Global Governance Studies at the University of Leuven. And Warren Wilcox is a Lecturer and Deputy Director of the Center for Gender Studies at Cambridge University. So a couple words about the ground rules, and then I'll shut up, we'll get started. So the roundtable organizers have put basically three questions to our speakers, and these include First, what does the concept of doomsday evoke for your area of research and or for international relations generally? Is the current prevailing level of pessimism about the future of world politics justified? And what can be done about the environmental, nuclear, and or political crises facing the world? Is there any hope? I think it's kind of the bottom line there. And so each of the speakers will have about 15 minutes to kind of opening salvo. And then we will open it up to questions from the floor. Malfred, we're going to start down at the end and work our way back to Axel. Before we begin, though, let me just say that none of this would have been possible if it weren't for the efforts of Carrie and Jackie and Alessandro and Oksana, and the unsung heroes here, I think, are Kate Jessup and Sophie Wise, who also worked in putting this together. So they really did all of this, and so they get all the credit. So with that, Milford, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Can you guys hear me okay? Good. If not, just wave and I'll speak up. First of all, let me just say how pleased I am to be back here, because I wrote my PhD here back in the day, and I spent many hours in this room listening to people, and it's really strange and lovely to be on this side of the room. So thank you so much for having me back. It's a real pleasure. So I guess I'm snapping back into student mode, you know, stepping into to the LSE, because I'm going to focus on answering the questions, which is what I was taught here. So let me start with the first one. What does the concept of doomsday mean for my area of research and for IR generally? Well, as someone who studies nuclear weapons, I take doomsday quite literally and certainly very seriously. The use of nuclear weapons in anger, by mistake, or by calculation can lead to the annihilation of cities and states. There are enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world many times over, and the aftermath would be apocalyptic. And so the prospect of doomsday is central for nuclear strategy and statecraft for states that have nuclear weapons. And primarily, states want to avoid doomsday, and that informs a lot of what they try to do in handling nuclear weapons. But the ways in which they do so, the strategies they adopt, are based on logics that are abhorrent to many, both to state leaders, but also to citizens and scholars. Concepts such as mutual assured destruction, the doomsday machine that we just heard about, command systems that include an automated countdown to a nuclear exchange that would, you know, destroy human life on Earth, which there was at one point in the Soviet Union and also in the United States. This is profoundly uncomfortable stuff, and it's this discomfort, I think, is evident amongst a lot of citizens today. It's evident in the debates about nuclear strategy and disarmament in Europe and elsewhere these days. But it's also, I think, quite evident in the strategic choices that state leaders make in states that have nuclear weapons, including, I would argue, Donald Trump at this very moment. Nuclear weapons are about more than doomsday, however. They've come to serve a broad range of purposes in international relations. They have come to signify status. They help to underpin outdated hierarchies. And they are important for bargaining. However, this prospect of annihilation of doomsday is always lurking there in the background. So the challenge for scholars who work in this field, who try to understand nuclear weapons and their effects on international relations, is figuring out how to understand and manage and perhaps even reduce the risks of nuclear annihilation. And we do so in a great number of ways, but they include some of the following. First, they include trying to understand the pathways to using nuclear weapons, whether through a calculated strategy, through miscalculation, through bargaining, or through mistakes. it's trying to understand how we can create strategic stability in a world where some states have nuclear weapons. And this is challenging at the moment because we see that nuclear weapon states have very different ideas about what strategic stability means for them, which makes it difficult for them to deal with each other. And for non-nuclear weapon states, strategic stability is looking more and more difficult to achieve these days because many of their allies are looking less credible as allies, and this leads many states to revisit earlier decisions to abstain from nuclear weapons themselves. Another way in which scholars are addressing these questions is trying to understand how and why these weapons are spread. And at this point in time, and I would say over the past year or so, scholars working on nuclear weapons are questioning a lot of assumptions that have informed our ideas and debates about nuclear weapons for many, many years. One set of disagreements concerns how nuclear weapons affect state behavior, and especially state behavior during crises. There's a new debate about whether the Cold War was as stable as we have thought. Probably not, is the tentative conclusion. And there's a fierce debate about how nuclear weapons affect state behavior during crises, where everyone is fiercely disagreeing with each other. There's another set of disagreements about the basic tenets of nuclear strategy and nuclear posture in nuclear weapon states. There are many debates about India and Russia at the moment, and there's an emerging debate about North Korea and their nuclear strategy and posture, where, of course, we know very little. But the fact that there are disagreements about even what these states want to do with their weapons, quite substantial disagreements, I think is something to take note of. Another set of disagreements concern the causes and drivers of nuclear proliferation, why states, new states, want to get nuclear weapons. This debate has been coming and going, like many of the others, but it's certainly back in business now that North Korea sort of surprised everyone, because hardly anyone predicted how successful North Korea's nuclear weapons program would be. And this has led to a real reckoning among those who've developed theories about nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation to try and see what we got wrong and try and see if we can fix what we may have, you know, gotten wrong to deal with other proliferation risks. Because there are many states in line at this point in time that may want to get nuclear weapons of their own. So the tentative conclusion of this sort of ongoing debate in my field is that we should be much less confident in terms of what we think we know about, you know, why states want nuclear weapons, what keeps them from getting them, and how they behave when they actually acquire these weapons. And certainly there's a real shift away from the optimism that's been around for about a decade or so, where states took steps to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in their arsenals, and President Obama talked about, you know, getting rid of nuclear weapons at some point in time. Scholars started saying that, you know, the rate of proliferation is slowing down and we shouldn't really worry about the new states that are trying to get nuclear weapons. Probably they won't be able to because they don't have the resources. A lot of those, you know, what we thought we knew in the previous decade is now being overturned, and so this is a really interesting and really important point in time where we sort of revisit many of those assumptions. And also, to give you guys a preview of the cheery direction of the rest of my comments, we're now facing a nuclear arms race. We're facing risks of greater nuclear proliferation. And we're also witnessing an erosion of global regimes to manage both proliferation and to manage arms control between states. And so to give a little sort of nod to IR theory, how should we think about all this? Well, some say that we're living through an experiment, both in deterrence theory, and we're living through an experiment where, I guess, structural realists would have a real shot at proving, you know, if state leaders aren't really that important. And I guess Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un will be challenging cases in points. And certainly, I think feminist analyses of nuclear weapons have had a real upswing since the Donald Trump became president in the United States. So I think there's a lot of food for thought here for people from different theoretical lenses. So the second question is the current pessimism justified? Yes. I would say we should worry, at least. I would say pessimism is the wrong mindset to adopt because, if anything, I think the nuclear age shows the importance of agency. Individuals have been essential to stop what could have become a nuclear weapons exchange. We've seen examples of this in the Soviet Union in 83, in 95, and there are many other examples too, where people have disobeyed their orders, used their common sense, and stopped a crisis from, you know, literally going nuclear. And furthermore, we see that state leaders, there's been a restraint against using nuclear weapons since 1945, and there have been many occasions where this has been a tempting prospect. So this suggests, you know, that agency matters and that nuclear disaster doomsday is not at all inevitable. However, at the current moment, we're facing new risks. Some of the challenges we're up against now were there during the Cold War as well. But the problem today is that we're facing greater uncertainty because there are many things that seem to be changing all at once in the current political and strategic environment. And this has to do, of course, with the US's changing role as an ally, different power relationships in different regions around the world. And this sort of uncertainty lends itself to miscalculation, which is what those of us who think about strategy really, really worry about a lot. So just to highlight three sets of issues that keeps me up at night. The first one is the prospect of a nuclear arms race between the US and Russia. And I think it's already happening, to be honest. And there's a fundamental issue that's driving this, and I think it has to do with deterrence and this discomfort with deterrence that I talked about initially. The United States is not comfortable with being vulnerable, and being vulnerable is part and parcel of the main approach to deterrence, mutual vulnerability, that has been present for a lot of the nuclear age. And so both the US and Russia are now opting for another way to deter, which is through war fighting options in order to try and control escalation. This is profoundly problematic because controlling escalation is extremely difficult and it requires having a lot of, you know, clear information about your opponent, their red lines, perfect communication, etc. And we all know, most of us follow Trump's Twitter account, that, you know, clear lines of communication and, you know, this is not really what we're seeing at the moment. So I think that this shift towards war fighting is profoundly disturbing, and it also risks lowering the nuclear threshold, which invites, you know, a lot of new risks. It's also based on a profound misunderstanding by both states, you know, regarding this sort of missile shield that the US is developing. The Russian government seems to think it's going to work really well when it isn't, and the US also seems to think it's going to work really well when it isn't going to work all that well. Whether or not it's going to work, it certainly lends itself to triggering this arms race, and those of you who saw Putin's recent speech will see that this is very much, you know, what's happening at the moment. Second set of issues, proliferation pressures, you know, that may lead other states to develop nuclear weapons. The challenges that are facing the Iran nuclear deal at the moment and the consequences of North Korea's successful nuclear weapons program could trigger further proliferation in Asia and the Middle East. South Korea, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and many other states. And this just comes on top on a host of other problematic developments, including this apparent erosion of US alliances that could lead many states to, you know, revisit earlier decisions to abandon nuclear weapons. The third issue is the collapse of bilateral arms control agreements and linked to this general weakening of the non-proliferation regime. And I just want to highlight that we're entering a stage where, for the first time in decades, the US and now Russia will probably not have arms control agreements that will sort of limit the amount of nuclear weapons they have. And if these continue to erode, that will have problematic consequences in terms of, you know, triggering or furthering this arms race. But this arms race can also spread and have implications for European strategic stability. Okay, so what can we do about any of this? Well, fortunately, there's a lot that states can do about all this. We know how to set up a non-proliferation regime that works. We have had one since 1970. We know how to do arms control because we've done that for decades. And we know how to do diplomacy to prevent crises from escalating. Oh, and by the way, it's not really the way in which the US is now trying to set up this summit with North Korea, because diplomacy requires a lot of careful planning and clear communication, etc. So certainly not what we're seeing right now. But to be able to do any of these things that we know actually work, we need updated information and sound analyses, particularly at a point in time when it seems that many of the key actors, the states themselves, do not seem to see this clearly enough. And this is where all of us come into the picture. Scholars have a really important mission these days, and I think the stakes are extremely high. So I will leave it there, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, Kate, what keeps you up at night?
So I'm also really delighted to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. And I've really enjoyed sort of spending the last day with the folks in the IPE cluster. So I will I will sort of take and the European Studies Center as well. So I will take seriously my sort of remit of thinking about doomsday in terms of international political economy. And I'm happy to say it's not quite as extreme and existential and sort of immediate as my colleague to my right. But that being said, I think, you know, this is an incredibly important consequential moment that we're in. So let me sort of outline how I approach the three questions. So I think thinking about sort of what is the doomsday that in the field of international political economy, at least on the side of the Atlantic that I'm on, how do people think about what doomsday means? And it seems very much that the doomsday is what we're seeing in terms of the populist backlash to the international liberal economic order, right? So the entire sort of structure of open markets, trade, investment, and so on that has grown over the post-war era, and that, as I will talk about, many people sort of took for granted as something that was going to last forever. So my argument is really that what we are seeing actually is shouldn't be that surprising. This backlash actually should not surprise us if we sort of step back and think more deeply about the interaction of politics and markets, and think more deeply, as some colleagues here in this room do, about the sort of historical trajectory of these things. That in fact, we lost sight, I would argue, in the sort of standard IPE literature, and certainly politically, of the inherent politics that are always with us when it comes to market interactions. That, you know, we have this problem of sort of only thinking about the moment we're in and thinking about that as sort of the only history that exists. And we forget that the post-war trajectory was very much from, you know, very closed markets coming out of World War II to Ruggie's, you know, embedded liberalism, right? Where markets actually are very carefully constructed to allow governments to protect their domestic societies, to what has happened over the last three decades or so, right, the rise of this sort of technocratic orthodoxy that really stripped away a lot of the embedded liberalism that the post-war order was really built upon. And I think we became mesmerized in the field of IPE and more generally in sort of the broader policy debates by this sort of end of history idea that I think Peter already mentioned, right? That we became blinded by the surface stability that we saw around us of the sort of, you know, the gap moving into the WTO and ever opening capital markets and investment flows and productions, you know, supply chains and so on. And that there was actually a sort of coalition of material and ideational reasons why those open markets were sort of abstracted out and made to seem this sort of inevitable victory, right, of this big open market. The logic of no alternative, if you like, really took center stage. And, you know, when I began teaching international political economy, there was this book, The World is Flat, which some of you may remember, right, by Tom Friedman, that really, I think, crystallized a lot of the sort of ideas of the time, that in fact, politics will inevitably be squeezed out by this sort of inevitable steamroller of the market, right? And for Friedman, you know, and for many people, this was viewed as a positive thing. Right, that politics actually got in the way of markets, right? So get politics out of markets and everyone will be better off. Well, it turns out it's like Hemingway says in The Sun Also Rises at the end, right? Isn't it pretty to think so, basically, right? That this notion that markets are separate and disembedded from politics is really only pretty. It's only a really attractive model if you're a winner, right, in that situation. And that inevitable ability of markets, you know, creates opportunity and hope for you, so isn't that terrific, right? But the problem, of course, was that over the last three decades, we've seen this incredible rise in inequality, right? And this sort of movement of the market into a much more sort of hyper-financialized market that actually doesn't reflect sort of underlying material productive realities, right? And so therein lies the problem. So what is the right model of markets that, in fact, international political economy folks should pay attention to and should sort of rebuild, would help us sort of rebuild in the face of this supposed doomsday thing? Well, those of you who know my work will not be surprised to hear me argue that we should think about markets not as this sort of separate sphere, but rather as structured by power and social logics, always and everywhere, even when they appear to be this sort of inevitable abstracted thing, right? This is not a new insight, you know. Karl Marx wrote about this a very long time ago, right? Polanyi, right, wrote about the notion of embedded markets as being crucial, right, that, you know, the sort of, you know, 19th century notion of the free market was constructed. But somebody like Robert Gilpin, right, also wrote about international markets as being a product, or Susan Strange, as being a product of underlying geopolitical orders, right? So many very smart people have sort of figured this out, but I really think that, you know, there was this very strange sort of period in which people became sort of caught up in this sort of fairy tale, right? But today, that's all, you know, smashed to bits, right? That in fact, the debates today really sort of engage with the notion that there are important distributive effects of this sort of revving up of the free market in a globalized sense. But what has disturbed me a little bit about the debate in my subfield, however, is that a lot of people have gone about thinking through these questions by separating out sort of economic material things and markets and identity and culture on the other side, right? So there's sort of lots of people testing out these questions, like Pippa Norris and Ron Engelhardt, lots of other people, where they test sort of, you know, can we predict or figure out who voted for Trump or Brexit, et cetera, or populist leaders in Europe, based on their sort of material economic situation, basically their income, right? Versus their attitudes, right? Are they racist or xenophobic, or is it about something with the economy? And I think this is exactly the wrong way of looking at it, that it sort of brackets and separates these two things and makes it sort of much too easy to just sort of go down the route of, it's really that they're all racist and that's all it is, and we just, you know, and we can't really fix that, right? Because that's something intrinsic and essential to who you are, right? I would argue that to understand our moment, we really need to think about markets much more as things that are made up of human beings, right, that are social creatures that live in political environments. And so markets very much are structured by power relations, right, are not sort of abstracted out from that, and that power can be based on economic material asymmetries. It can be based on sort of coercive practices. It can be based on symbolic and sort of status things, and culture and identity as well, that this stuff is intertwined, right? So when we think about something like class, we need to really think about how class identities are much more than just simple economic realities, right? That actually identities structure markets, and your identity is actually structured by your market position as well, right? So let me just give you a really simple example. Today I was looking at the Upshot published, the New York Times published a really interesting results of a study where they looked at your income that you were born into and then looked at your race, and this is for men, you guys saw this, right? And it turns out, of course, that race will dampen very heavily the effects of what you were born into in terms of your income. That black men tend to fall off, even though their parents may be very high income folks, they get fall off from that, right? So clearly something else is going on. Race really matters. It structures markets and market outcomes. But I would argue that economic realities also then turn back and help structure the way people think about their own interests and whether something like Make America Great Again makes sense for them or not, right? I think one way of thinking about this is to think about the reality that working class white people and working class black people and working class Hispanics don't all share, right, the same class identity necessarily, right? Those things are divided up. And I would argue, as somebody who thinks that that identities are constructed over time, that these are not intrinsic things, that we need to probe into why is it that class identities get constructed in one way and not another, in ways that actually may make it easier for us to divide workers and not think about the distributional effects of things like ever-opening markets, right? Of things like the world is flat, right? Why did that sort of mentality win out over thinking about the rights of workers and the experience of workers, right? So we really need to interrogate the interaction of these things, how markets can reverberate back on identities, how motivated political actors can construct and frame and use those various phenomena to their own purposes to create political parties and coalitions to further their own ends. All right, so back to Doomsday. What's the bottom line here, right? I would argue that the liberal order absolutely needs reform because it was failing the very people who need to support it, right? Global poverty has declined over time. The liberal order has brought many good things. My father, funny enough, was actually a trade negotiator and believed in free trade. I believe in free trade. I believe in the power of markets. But as a political scientist and somebody who, you know, has to mention Polanyi at every single topic, yeah, basically, it seems very clear to me that this is simply not politically sustainable, even setting aside the normative qualms that we might have about rising inequality, right? That mainstream political parties have, in fact, perhaps governed very well, but they haven't represented, right? They haven't actually been able to provide the types of embedded liberalism that I think was crucial to the beginning of the post-war era. So we really need, you know, it's my sort of answer to avoiding the doomsday outcome. The doomsday outcome would be sort of, you know, for us to continue down this route of sort of, it's either identity or economic anxiety. Put the, you know, identity concerns and resentment in one box and just blame it on some sort of essentialist notion that these people are just awful, stupid racists, right? I think that mainstream political parties absolutely need to grapple with the commitments to market orthodoxy and to removing the social safety nets that I would argue allow markets to work better, right? We have tons of data on this, right? People are more innovative and competitive if they actually feel some sense of support and they can take risks and so on. And so I would love to see sort of the liberal order reconstructed in a way that allows it to be more sustainable and actually creates equality over time and reduces the very dramatic inequality that we've seen. And I believe that that is the only way forward, that the other way forward of just ignoring all of this and blaming it on sort of culture and identity in a box would actually produce a very bad result in the long run.
So, thank you. Lauren, the floor is yours.
Here's another 3 minutes. Recycling.
I make them up.
Thanks, and I want to thank thank the organizers for having me down here. In my talk today, I'm drawing on some work. I assume the reason why I've been invited was because I wrote a piece on the apocalypse in the last issue of Millennium. So it's about zombies a little bit. So I'm not going to talk about zombies today. I'm sorry. You're all going to leave now. I think what I'm going to have to say is going to dovetail with what Kate says nicely and perhaps kind of push even further a bit kind of on that aspect because of the work on that I've been doing here on race and racialization. And here is, I am also speaking as a student. I was a student here at the LSE 15 years ago now, in my master's. But I am, in terms of the work I'm doing right now, I am kind of a student of black feminist thought that has gone much further than I have about this. And here I'm influenced by Alexis Gums, for example, whose book M Archive, After the End of the World, is coming out this week. He writes about the ways in which black feminist thought is always already after the end of the world. And I'm going to talk about what that means and I think what that can tell us. I guess I'm supposed to be representing IR theory, and that's a big burden here. I'm going to speak to all of it here in little ways. But for me, the question of doomsday is always a question about what kinds of worlds are ending. What is this about? We can imagine.
That's kind of obvious.
Physical. Sure.
Not for us.
Right, but I mean, there's going to be a planet here. Most rocks. Okay. Anyway. consider just how often, kind of in popular culture, that we imagine the end of the world.
Yeah.
Okay. Various different ways. From films and culture and whatnot. What is the end of the. What the end of the world means for humans, or for a good life, or for a civilized life, or for planetary life in general. And what are kind of the narratives we're telling ourselves about the end of the world? And I know, I have a good sense of why we're here today talking about this a little bit. Because we're a little terrified about at least two possible crazy madmen with their fingers on nuclear buttons. And I'm just going to... for once, I'm going to refrain from my feminist rant on this. This is usually what I can do. You can check my Twitter feed if you want to hear that. Twitter is not going to save the world, possibly end the world. But I think, anyways, I think doomsday apocalypse, these narratives are not only worlds, about the world ending, but I think they're world revealing and also kind of world making at the same time, stories we tell ourselves. And I can talk a little bit, first of all, about this clock. Okay. So nobody kind of really got into this before, and I'm not really into this. People have written about this, but that there's a sense in which it's to get to midnight is the apocalypse, and we're always kind of a little closer, a little further. I mean, we're never at kind of like, 6 p.m. or a.m. or something like this. We're never like real far from it. We're like, from it. But it's of course not just nuclear, but it's also climate change and bioterrorism and artificial intelligence now. But I think, what is this? What does this tell us about time, and what's the relationship of time and the end of the world that is doing here? We can think about the clock as this kind of capitalist modern item itself. For example, attacked by all kinds of revolutionaries as a symbol of wage labor and modernity and time by Haitian revolutionaries. So what kinds of end of the world are working here? So there's a sense in which midnight is both a kind of beginning and an ending. It's this very revolutionary idea of time, okay? What Mary Dudziak talks about in wartime, that regular time is interrupted, we're time out of order. This is, again, this beginning and this end at the same time, the end of something and the beginning of something else. So what's ending and what's beginning? Here is the question. So this idea here is that this clock means that we're close. But, I mean, I'd suggest that for all your doomsday scenarios, they're already happening, okay? And what I'm going to focus on today is how they've already happened. So we can talk a lot about the ways in which climate change is already happening, and the various toxicities. We can talk about the environment. We can talk about which people are the most affected by this already, and seeing effects between hurricanes and deforestation and whatnot, and the effects of nuclear power already. From not just accidents, but this, and what kinds of worlds are this. And I think that the clock idea really misses some of this. And the clock idea produces this idea that we're in normal time right now, but we're about to get to something else. Okay. And I think this is a really problematic way of thinking. Right? I'm in gender studies, and we think everything's problematic. This is what we do. But for real, there's something about the clock idea that is sort of missing, I think, a deeper truth. about ways in which we have to imagine, you know, it's ongoing. And again, this is what worlds are ending and what worlds for humor ending. So I think Kate, I think you're, I mean, of course, we're all a little more terrified than usual about nuclear war these days. And of course, I think the reason why we're here, right, is we can think about the rise of populism that has brought in Brexit and Trump and Italy and all those other really worrisome things in which, like, look, you know, I don't like any of that, right? You know, it's not great. But we can think about the rising use of ethnic and racial prejudices, misogyny and anti-queer as kind of backlash. And we can think about this in order to stop or secure some kind of social order that leads us to think about the end of the world or the threat of living under this doomsday here. So this isn't real, but I'm suggesting here, what if we looked at a certain kind of literature that has said that the apocalypse has already happened and some people have already lived through it. Okay? And so what is it from that tradition, what can we learn about how we think about the apocalypse, this, or whatever this we might be is, and how might we live through it and survive from the kind of sense of people who've been there. So here, I'm working with a certain kind of black feminist liberation that presents us, you know, from, say, Fanon or Césaire, that says the goal here is the end of the world. Okay? It is a very deep, a very radical sense of the end of a certain kind of modernity and the end of a certain category of the human that has been understood you know, to be profoundly destructive of a certain project. So that looks like an apocalyptic plan, but it again is that question of what worlds are we destroying and what worlds are we building in the wake from that. So how do we imagine, you know, the end of the world? And here I'm kind of, again, this is where I'm suggesting and kind of drawing from black feminist thought that's kind of already always after the end of the world here. And you know, thinking about this idea, this, you know, from ways in which, for example, we can talk about how IR is always imagined, you know, since it's a discipline, always imagined the end of the world. Like, what is a Hobbesian state of nature, right? If not an apocalyptic narrative of something else, okay, about this, in which external authorities can be called upon to save people from this. And this arguably structures IR theory as a whole from, you know, of course, you know, Martin White's vision of recurrence and repetition outside of any possible achievement of a good life. I mean, that looks like the end of the world, if that happens here, in our nasty, brutish, and short lives here. But I wanted to draw on work such as that by Sylvia Winter, who looks at the ways in which our contemporary racial and capitalist societies are both cause and effects of market economies themselves, who Winter maintains that the particular emergence of this novel form that's inextricably linked with historical developments of the conquest of the Americas and the plantation societies of the Caribbean that provide the raw material for extension and dominance of market economy and initiated a globally expansive reordering of the kind of aesthetic and our imaginative capacities themselves. So we have a ways in which slavery and colonialism were not only about the kind of conscription of black people into these imperialist and racialized conceptions of modernity and universal humanity, but also that, you know, in terms of Western modernity's conception, you know, condition of possibility itself. So Western modernity, the thing that we are afraid is coming to an end, structured itself on the basis of slavery. And so this transatlantic slavery needs to be considered kind of epical rupture here in this. And so that kind of division that marked people, you know, that eradicated certain forms of difference and marked people as commodity and goods only in terms of market value and that form of commodification out of which this whole world grew. That we are talking about here. So I'm drawing some in, you know, for some of the rest of my comments here from say, Spiller's or Winter or Alison Healy's work on Hobby's Viscus that looks at a sense of a kind of structural anti-blackness in the system where racialization is about disciplining, you know, sets of relations that discipline humanity into full humans, not quite humans, and not humans in a system of unequal power relationships. And this is something that IR is only really recently been trying to grapple with some more, and the ways in which IR has kind of theorized around some of the white supremacist and colonialist legacies that were part of its inception as a field of study and a ways of understanding the world. In my piece about this that I published, and I'm drawing on work with my co-author Stephanie Fischel, in the piece I published in Millennium, we looked at the zombie. As I mentioned about this, but it's really a way into apocalyptic narratives and the end of the world. And we made two interventions about the use of the zombie in IR. One is a way to re-theorize race, racism, and exceptionalism, like states of exception, bare life, and the other is to kind of recapture the power of the zombie narrative to think about the politics of racialization, contagion, and enclosure in contemporary global politics, with the claim that the kind of race-free or race-blind theorizations of bare life and exceptionalism have been about avoiding race and racialization in IR theory. So we want to argue that post-apocalyptic narratives can basically be described as describing white folks experiencing the conditions of bare life, slavery, or colonial conquest. In other words, dramatizing white people living under the conditions they forced upon others. And so in these narratives, dramatizing people living, say, in Christina Sharpe's evocative phrase, in the wake of such scenarios. And so that kind of draws upon the aftermaths of the Middle Passage and slave in America resonate with this post-colonial language here. So we'll talk more about neoliberalism, but we're going to move on here to talk about some of the work that, say, Hortense Spillers does and the concept of what do we do when the kind of notion of the human or of man itself is kind of contaminated by a kind of structural anti-blackness and modernity. And so we're looking not at ways of living on and surviving that are about inclusion or recognition within this narrative, but rather are about formulating a different genre of the human in ways that, perform a theorization of survival in the wake of these kinds of racializing assemblages of subjection. So this is the kind of, where Healy borrows from Spillers on this concept here. So the category of habeas viscus, or the flesh, is not to replace bare life or the camp with the plantation or slave ship as the kind of hidden matrix of modern political life. But the term is meant as a kind of afterlife of bare existence, as a way to understand political agency outside of white supremacist understandings of man. So, for example, where is rebellion when enslaved in the camp or the prison or on the slave ship or plantation? So Healy writes, the flesh, rather than displacing bare life or civil death, excavates the social afterlife of these categories. It represents racializing assemblages of subjection that can never annihilate the lines of flight, freedom dreams, practices alliteration, and possibilities of other worlds. So it provides an entry point into rethinking the question of agency as a different concept of humanity here. So this is a way of thinking about, how can we think about this, kind of narrative as a way to kind of, as a guide for understanding and as a guide for healing, so not just kind of reflecting, this sort of reality. And we can think about, a lot of the ways where, for example, we used to think about spaces of isolation like Guantanamo or islands or plantations or reservations as kinds of spaces for exception, but now in our kind of contemporary post-apocalyptic imaginaries, so these kind of spaces like these bunkers or people buying their own islands or whatever that are, holding up in New Zealand are for like the ultra 0.01% of 1% to hide from the rest of us, and the rest of the space, is kind of under this threat of that.
Bonvillains.
Yeah, well, sure, okay. from this. In my kind of practice of reading, I'm learning from these kinds of post-apocalyptic stories of learning on outside of our terms of modern politics that have more symbolic resonance about this. And so so Womack, for example, writes about the post-apocalyptic tales that can be used for strategic planning about the future of African-American communities who live in abandoned urban centers in New York City, New Orleans after Katrina, Cincinnati, and Detroit. And about the ways in which, these are places that we associate with the end of the world, but it's not the end of the world, it's the beginning of something else. Other people use Octavia Butler's series of the parables. So I will go on forever. I do not have enough time to go on forever about this. Please see me later to talk about Octavia Butler and her parables and her Lilith's Brood as kind of feminist Afrofuturist literature that provides kinds of templates that have resonances with the kinds of escape to freedom or great migration that can, provide kind of alternative ways of building survival and building community, assuming certain notions of change, as becoming essential to to kind of different modes of thinking about the human and its relationship with planet and its relationship with its sort of constitutive others there. So I think I've got to wrap it up here about this, but I just kind of want to leave you with a quote by Octavia Butler, who says, "There is nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns." So there.
Axel, you need to get access
yes.
here?
Yes.
So I can switch.
I have a PowerPoint. Okay. So I'm going to approach this a bit from a different angle. And first, try maybe to introduce some optimism, and then also maybe to bring it back a bit to down. But I broadly come from the area, let's say, of global governance of sustainable development. And from that area, the whole idea of a doomsday clock is, let's say, nothing new in the sense that there's some kind of a constant of crises. And if you go back in the literature, you have the Club of Rome, you have the limits to growth, you have this constant literature basically on the social and environmental challenges with which we are confronted. And this is, of course, became very famous in this catchword of pursuing sustainable development. And this is now further taken on board by the United Nations in the Sustainable Development Goals. And there is this constant search to address social and environmental issues related to, inter alia, globalization and so on. Now, there are clear signs that addressing these challenges are not always easy from an intergovernmental type of perspective, and there was this whole rhetoric about limits of intergovernmentalism at a stalemate, and so on. But at the same time, from the 1990 onwards, we saw the emergence of what we call non-state forms of global governance, non-state forms of market regulation. And there I actually come to the third question which was posed to us. Can we see developments which might give us some hope on addressing these social and environmental issues? And that's where much of my research focuses on specific forms of non-state forms of market regulation to address these issues. And you might probably know them best by all the different types of labels we see in the streets and on the products we buy. And they are basically all different forms or different initiatives which try to address sustainable development issues in global markets. And over the years, we have seen an enormous growth of these standards and labels over time. And that actually gave quite some authors a hope in the sense that what we have seen is the emergence of a new form of governance. What we have seen is the emergence of a new way to address sustainable development issues. And you had these books on the certification revolution, on the rise of civil regulation as a non-state form to address global issues. And if you plot over time, you will see that we have more than 400 of these new forms of governance to address sustainable development issues. So that might actually give us some hope that even if there are, let's say, limitations to what we can do with intergovernmental cooperation, there might be very different forms on how to regulate or govern markets, which might emerge and which might help us out in that respect. So in the remainder, I actually want to go a bit into the research which we are doing, and a lot of other scholars, including Matthias, looking at the effectiveness of these types of things. Is this hope justified? Can we really expect much from that in the longer term or in addressing sustainable development issues? And I briefly want to touch on three things. First, are these new institutional forms of global governance designed to effectively pursue sustainable development or achieve changes? Second, what do we know about the impact on the ground of these types of initiatives? And third, How well or to what degree are they adopted across the globe if we really want to use them to address global issues? First, on the institutional design of these, of many of these initiatives. We have now, I think, over the last 10, 15 years, quite a few studies which look at what's actually behind these labels. What do they try to achieve? And that's a more technical sense. What type of standards do they want to follow through? But more importantly, how do they want to enforce all these sustainable development commitments by the different actors they want to regulate, mostly firms? And what type of mechanisms do they put in place to address a non-compliance? And if we look throughout these studies, we actually see that there are very significant differences between all these types of systems in terms of how they are designed. And in a nutshell, what comes out of much of this research is that you have quite a bit of greenwashing labels, where you have a lot of labels which basically do not have any enforcement mechanisms whatsoever. So they're actually not even designed to change anything, but that's a bit, let's say, the story they want to tell. And they start operating in the market, and they created their own market for labels. That's one part, let's say, of the labels. On the other hand, you also see that you have some of these labels who have an extensive set of procedures to develop standards, to enforce them, and to really try to make a change on the ground. But it's important to understand that behind these different types of initiatives, there are very large variation. Now, if we look at the impact on the ground, do they really make a difference on the ground? There are a lot of studies now coming out using different parameters, looking at different economic sectors, using different methodologies, and the results are very uneven or very inconclusive in the degree that some studies find positive effects, some studies find negative effects, some studies find that there's actually very little impact of these types of initiatives. To give you one example, there's a study by the Committee on Sustainability Standards, which actually did a meta-review on many different surveys which compared farms which are certified, so which adhere to these sustainability standards, and farms which do not adhere to these sustainability standards. And their study comes out in large with quite some positive results, showing that the certified farms perform much better in terms of yield, income, and so on. But if you look for quite a few different other studies, you might find some mixed results and counter results. More troubling, I think, from the perspective, what I'm studying most is these standards which look at the protection of labor rights. And there you have a lot of stories coming out or which emerged, which actually showed the limits of these types of mechanisms to address labor rights. And you might all remember these pictures of the Rana Plaza, a large building which collapsed in Bangladesh. There was basically a five-story building, and on each floor there were manufacturing of textiles. And actually on one of these manufacturing companies in the Rana Plaza was certified according to one of these standards. Another example is the Karachi fire in Pakistan, which killed more than 300 people, which also was certified a couple of weeks before the fire broke out. And that, of course, spurs a lot of debate on the possibilities and limits of these types of systems to address quite a few of these social issues. And quite a few of these standards are quite aware of the challenges they have, and they try to change the enforcement mechanisms they have. But still, this type of examples, and it's actually anecdotal evidence, shows that there are clear limits in terms of the impact on the ground, what these types of initiatives can produce. Finally, if we look at the adoption in terms of where are these standards operating and what are they doing and which countries are they mainly operating. It's interesting to see where they make a difference, because even if we would assume that you have a set of standards which is designed to really foster changes on the ground, and if you really assume that even on the ground they make strong changes, then we still have to look where are these changes happening, and that's in terms of what you look when you look at the adoption. And one of the standards we studied, the Forest Stewardship Council, which actually tries to promote sustainable forest management or sustainable development in the forest sector, we collected data on which where the forest owners and where the firms are which are certified, and then plotted that on a map to see where they're active. And as you can see, the blue and the yellow colors are the places where forest certification is taking place. The gray colors, there is no adoption of these type of voluntary standards. And if you look more at the figures of that, we also do it for other standards, you see that they are mostly active in high-income countries or middle-income countries, but that low-income countries are hardly in any way affected by these standards, and it's actually sometimes in these types of countries where you want to make changes towards sustainable development. And we have labeled that you have some kind of a stuck at the bottom problem, where you have this new type of market mechanism which is actually taken up in some countries but not in others. And actually the stuck at the bottom problem was recently confirmed in a very interesting study by Kay Taylor and a lot of colleagues, which plotted for a lot of agricultural commodities where certification is taking place, and looking at whether they are taking place in areas where there's real need in terms of environmental issues and where there's real need in terms of social issues, in terms of poverty elevation. And what they showed is that, first of all, the overall adoption of certification is very limited, and also where it's adopted, it's mainly in middle-income countries, lesser in low-income countries. And what these figures show, this is for coffee, the dark green spots are certified entities, and the shallow green colors is where coffee is grown. So they basically make a plot on where in the world is certification taking place, and they do that for a lot of commodities. And in case of coffee, they show that 9% of all surface areas which is used to grow coffee is certified. But if we look at other types of commodities, like palm oil or even sugarcane, only very, very limited amount of areas which produce for sugarcane are certified. So, from my perspective, if we look a bit on this challenge of the doomsday, and whether we can have new initiatives which might give us some hope on how to address them. Most of the research we are doing is looking at these new forms of private regulation, which I would say 10 or 15 years ago gave us hope in terms of addressing social and environmental concerns in governing markets. But as the evidence builds up, we can only see that hope is justified to a limited degree, and whether you then think limited is the glass is half full or glass empty, that's of course open for debate. There's a lot of contradictory evidence in that respect, but I think it's important to not overestimate what can be done through these types of initiatives. And then, of course, the question emerges, what type of other governance mechanisms can be developed or can be used to address these sustainable development issues. Thank you. Thank you.
So we have about 20 minutes to work with, which is not a lot of time. So I think the floor is open for general questions, specific questions. James.
So this is a question for Lauren. This is a question for Lauren. So that was a really interesting way to think about it, and it's so nicely followed from the two prior talks. And a great way to end it. There's nothing under the sun, but there are other suns. Well, so I have one short and then one larger concern. The short and simple one is the simple Keynesian point that the other equilibrium might be really hard to get to and might be really costly. So there are other suns, but they're light years away. And so how do we know that the equilibrium that could be better for us, the post-apocalyptic equilibrium, isn't also like the actual other suns in the universe?
Post-apocalyptic equilibrium, I have to
write it. So that's the simple one. Slightly more involved...
Sorry, that's a simple one.
But let's say it is close. Okay, so let's say that it is close and we can get to a different equilibrium. You're exactly right, and I take your point very much that the liberal order, post-world order, is built on the backs of people who are dispossessed and disembodied and disenfranchised, and I see that critique. But isn't there some sense in which the devil we know might be preferable to the devil we don't know? And the three figures I have in mind are Hegel, Nietzsche, and Lenin, all of whom promise a new world order after the apocalypse that's going to liberate all kinds of people in every scenario, and instead we get Napoleon, Hitler, and Stalin.
Do you
want to
take a
couple? Yeah, it is.
Well, sorry to jump in, but I meant to, in a sense, ask a question which was the reverse of yours, in a sense. So, yes, you had Napoleon and Hitler, but would you have had the abolition of slavery without the Napoleonic Wars? Would you have had, after World War II, without World War II, would you have had suffrage for women? Would you have had the Keynesian welfare states after World War II? So it seems to me, would you have new ways of organizing non-state governance without Rana Plaza? So you have a crisis, 1,000 people die overnight, basically. But then the new initiatives that came up after that, arguably, they plug some holes, some major holes. For instance, pre-commitment in the buying behavior of the war. So is the question not more when a crisis is worth it? Okay, so we as scholars tend to privilege gradualism. Yes, we want improvements, but let's try to minimize the cost. But then at some point we need to ask ourselves, okay, but if the crisis at some point seems to be necessary for some progress, how shall we conceptualize the decision involved, and should we not rather kind of foster a little bit of crisis, maybe not nuclear Armageddon, but say, okay, maybe we need a little bit of something to shake things a little bit.
So who wants the Schumpeter question? any other questions? Back here, Una.
Yeah. It's actually a point that relates up to the two previous points that were made, and it's just kind of a restatement of the last point that was made. So in your kind of narrative of different kinds of understanding of the apocalypse, what I always struggle with is how do we tell a story of the post-apocalyptic order, the construction of the new sun, that does not presuppose the greater sacrifice of those who are already oppressed under the current sun. Mm-hmm. So most revolutionary tales are built on the blood and tears of those who are already, under bonds and blood and tears. And this is why I kind of get uncomfortable about narratives like Brexit is a new beginning, built on already the working class of the British people, and the people who are neoliberal elites will still make money off of this. Trump is a corrective built off of the backs of the racially oppressed and the working class of America, while the neoliberal elites will still make money off of this, right? So how do we construct a narrative that's not based upon us as intellectual, economic, social elites telling those who are already oppressed, you need to bear that burden again?
So, Lauren, I think you'll get the first bite at the apple, but I think these are pretty general, and so maybe we'll start with you and then let everybody have a shot or bite.
Maybe I'll just kind of go backwards with that. Thanks for your question. I guess I want to clarify here. I'm not like an accelerationist, you know, with this. I wouldn't want to imply, of course, that Trump and Brexit are actually heading us toward the greater good, toward liberation of us all. You know what I mean? Kind of like the Columbia River Collective said that, you know, when black women are liberated, then we'll all be liberated. Like that is not what I think we're headed to with this. You know, and so that is kind of not what I'm thinking here. I meant it as a kind of more general, kind of a way into thinking about, you know, what do we mean when we're talking about the apocalypse and whose apocalypse are we centering, right, from this. So because I, of course, think you're right about you know, a kind of project that, you know, is presupposing greater sacrifice from them. Like, of course you're right in that. And I think about in my own work about the ways in which I'm just, you know, kind of trying to read and think as much as I can and not, you know, sort of to take this on as a white woman myself and just sort of think and learn and not to try to make people teach me too much on their own for that. So I guess to me how I read the New Suns, right, instead of this, is to say that we don't have to fix the current world order and preserve it as it is, right, for this. Or just try to maybe make more people, maybe make it a little more inclusive, maybe kind of fix it around the edges. We can maybe broaden our political imaginations to imagine something new and better. So which gets me to, what's your name?
James,
that's right. Question about this, and I'm just, my mind's blown a little bit, right, from this subtly, but I guess what I mean is I'm not talking about post-war liberal order, which is what everybody's kind of freaking out about right now. About this, I'm talking about like a racial capitalist order, right? That is like close to 500 years old. About this is what I'm talking. It was closer to what I'm talking about from this, and so I'm kind of drawing upon a whole kind of Black Rabbit tradition, you know, about this, from Cedric Robinson to Elena Patterson to talk about this, and so and that is said that. That the racial capitalist order has not been abolished in this time, since the end of slavery or the end of, you know, Concur or whatnot. And so I take your question in some sense to be, well, what if we get rid of this order? Could the next order be worse? Yeah, okay. Sure, but I'll tell you right now, it's already really violent. So I see this as like the shift will be really violent and it will dispossess people, okay? People already being dispossessed and it's already really violent that's built within it. And so maybe how about we give it a try to not do that, right? To unravel it, because it's we're not at a kind of everything's fine right now and the future might be more violent, and so we have to keep it like it is. It's already really, really violent. And so I don't know that the call here is pro doomsday in order to make, you know, the liberal order go away. I don't know that we what could we do in order to unravel this. You know what I mean? As I don't know if that's necessarily any kind of if there's any kind of tension or inconsistency with that, but that's what I'll say there. And I'm not going to say anything about any Keynesian equilibriums. I'll leave that for others.
Can I jump in real quick because I'm going to get more questions. But I think, you know, this question about, you know, when is a crisis worth it and what does it really take is incredibly important and interesting. And I actually have a piece with Dan Kellerman at Rutgers where we think about the EU as a sort of emergent political entity and compare it to the history of state building and talk about its incomplete political development, right? So currency, no fiscal union, Schengen, no hard border, etc., as potentially partly a cause of the fact that, you know, war made the state made war, and the EU actually didn't, you know, it was in the aftermath of war, but there was no kind of political space opened up for the kind of centralization of power over certain things, right? So our story is almost that, yeah, actually, it would have been better if there was like some kind of violent, you know, coercive moment that allowed for these powers to be concentrated in a way that's more functional. But, you know, I'll leave it at that. The second thing is around this question about sort of, you know, how should we sort of think about all this? And I will come back to Milford's point about agency, right? I mean, I think the point is that we should be able to try to think about how to design worlds which, you know, are not just sort of recreating past inequalities and so on, and break things and have everything fall apart. But what I'm so struck by is sort of the collapse of political leadership over the last little while, right? With Brexit, with Trump, with et cetera, in the sense that, you know, it's sort of stunning to me how craven and opportunistic the leaders are who are in charge of these really big things. So I'm just assuming your generation will fix it. That's my hope. No, in all seriousness, it really is about sort of making sure we empower each other and move forward with agency on these incredibly important issues.
Melford, what about like in the security area where crises, can they have the kind of effect that Matthias is suggesting? I was thinking about like the Cuban Missile Crisis, basically opened the space for the Limited Test Ban Treaty, and arguably the NPT wouldn't have been possible without it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a book that just came out last year, Violence as a Generative Force, and I think it delves into quite a few of those issues, but also the historical literature shows that when you go really close to the brink, if you accept, you know, that that image, sometimes that can be quite productive in terms of actors taking measures to step quite, you know, further away from the brink. One thing that did strike me, though, as I was thinking about these apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic scenarios, was that in the nuclear area we have a few of those. Of course, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, rebuilding afterwards, but also scholars like Merce Tate wrote this fantastic study of what nuclear testing did to Pacific Islanders, and I think that if we want to get away from the sort of typical Western capital framework and ways of thinking about this, some of her work might be a very instructive place to begin.
Excellent.
Maybe quickly on Matthias' point on a crisis as some kind of a critical juncture, which might also have beneficial effects. That is, of course, too, and I think that what happened after the Rana Plaza, you might have the effect that some of these systems really started to think how they might operate differently and start to change their procedures and so on. But you also have to make a net balance, because I think the Rana Plaza also did a lot of, let's say, had some negative effects about discrediting this type of form of governance. Quite a few large companies and retailers who were working quite a bit with voluntary standards are now looking again for different ways and seeing them not as, let's say, the correct way of addressing some of the social issues. So there's always a bit of a net balance, but I would never assume that a crisis is always good. You might need some at some points, and there might be some positive effects that for some of these crises, but in general, you also have to take the negative side on it.
Is that Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a crisis go to waste? Karen, it's a long day.
I also, with respect to the EU, I'm remembering what Chris Hill
said. Hold on, 1 second.
What Chris Hill once said, which was the EU has a way of, crisis, there's no crisis, you know, in other words, never recognizing that there is a crisis, so that if you just say there is no crisis and we're just going to continue as you ignore it, well then we're only talking about European integration, we're not talking about nuclear, so that there is something, but you have to recognize that it's a crisis, and that therefore change has to follow. If you don't, then it's just, well, we're just going to muddle through this and everything will be okay in the end. One of the things I'm wondering about the current period is, are we really in a crisis? I mean, and what is different about now compared to any other period of time?
I'm not going to answer that. I'm just going to say, so with the EU, failure produces leaps forward except when it doesn't. Right? I mean, you're exactly right. Lots of times it doesn't.
I think the point of what's now different is a very good question.
Right.
Obviously, in terms of political leadership, we are now in a very different state than we were a couple of years ago. Also, if you look, I think, about intergovernmental cooperation, multilateralism, the idea of addressing global challenges, is in this day very different from, let's say, what we had the Millennium Development Goals, we had the Sustainable Development. We had some hope for, let's say, joint action. I think this is quite fastly eroding in the last year, in the last 2 years. Having said that, it can also be reversed, I think, quite quickly if we have a change in leadership or a change in different political developments. Because now I think things go very, very quickly. We had the Brexit, we had Trump. Then at one point we thought, oh, France will vote for a racist president, but that then was reversed. We had similar tendencies in other European countries. So, but I do think that's quite different.
Go ahead.
I think one thing that...
We'll just wait for the mic, I think. Since we're paying for the mic, we might want to...
Thanks very much. So I think one thing which changes is that we have no utopia left. I mean, the whole thing that we talk about dystopias without ending is something which makes a difference. Because if we are in a crisis and you have a way to think, well, at the end of the tunnel, there's this which will come up, fine, we don't. And I think it makes a huge difference. And it's not just agency in that regard, or at least so I think. Coming back, it's for Kate McNamara. I like very much the idea that the end of the liberal order is actually of our own making, right? So if I understand correctly, the first part of your talk is, I hope in the new forthcoming I.O. issue somebody will write that instead of having always the other guys being responsible for the decline of the liberal order. Basically, we killed it ourselves. Now, once we killed it, is there any way actually that we can get the goes back into the bottle? Because the big question is, after all, and it comes back time and again, even after the 2008 crisis, the very, can I say, modest attempts to re-regulate have been taken away. The privatization is just going on, basically, in every regard. The commodification of different parts of our life is going on right and left. And there's nothing left of the liberalism, of this embedded liberalism, which there is. And so I think the doomsday for me is, or what we are thinking about is that maybe capitalism might survive in one way, maybe even the planet will survive in one way. It's not quite sure whether democracy will survive in the way that we have been thinking about it beforehand. So it's not liberalism in the free trade or whatever which is the issue. It's actually the undermining of all of the institutions that have been built up afterwards, and the domestic level even more than on the international, because it's the basis for making those reforms at the multilateral level. So I'm not hoping for the doomsday nor any crisis, and it seems that by the escalation that doomsday would be so doomsday that there's not much afterwards that we can rebuild. But then, what would be the question is, what would be the social forces necessary in order to get us? I mean, you say agency, but which agency would be necessary to get us there again?
So before you start, I was looking at the clock, and it's 3 minutes to...
3 minutes.
So we need to wrap this up. And so what would be really great is if you start, and then everybody have an opportunity, right? That's about let's call it 4 minutes to a minute.
You're using my time.
Right.
Okay. I agree with everything you said. When I was doing the talk, that was one of the routes I was going to go, was sort of, the democracy liberalism route. We killed the liberal order ourselves. I do think, though, that it is terribly important how this debate is adjudicated over racism, xenophobia versus economic anxiety. In the United States, that is incredibly consequential for the way certainly the Democratic Party is reconstituting itself, and people are sort of lining up on either side of that. And that, is something that I think we have to get behind us and move forward. So, but I 100% agree, we could have had a whole thing about sort of the erosion of democratic institutions and norms, right, which has been very important, and the tensions there.
Who's next?
Alfred? Laura?
Not really.
It's a final word before it actually goes off.
Who wants to be between the party and the, That's true.
Now it literally is 2 minutes.
Well, I would say, I really would, in all
seriousness, right? Agency is important in the sense that don't give up. I mean, this is an incredibly important and consequential moment when all this stuff is breaking wide open. And so we really need, and I think you put this beautifully, you know, scholars, all of us, we really need to make sure that our voices are being heard and that we feel like we are contributing, hopefully, to moving to a better future, whatever we think that might be.
We cannot do any better than that.